Inside Security Podcast with Martin and Steve Yvette and Little Joe. News Yankee Steve giving weekly updates. Armor guy managing the microphones. Joseph's there and sparkles while the vet's in the airport. Andy Googles Microsoft on his iPhone. A family-friendly bucket full of southern goodness. What will they be ranting about this week?
It's episode 189 of the Southern Fried Security Podcast. My name is Martin Fisher. We are so glad to be back with you in 2017. Just candidly, we've made a couple changes, and you longtime listeners will be able to figure this out pretty quickly. But what I want to do real quickly is we have everybody here on the line. So with me, Andy Willingham. Andy, how are you?
I'm just trying to keep a straight face.
Aren't we all? Steve Reagan is also here. Steve, how are things?
Well, I can't travel overseas, but things are good.
Well, we're just going to leave that there.
That's a loaded answer.
Yeah.
Wow.
Joseph Sicoli is here with us. Joseph.
Hey, it's good to be back. I've missed you guys.
It's so good to have you back, man. And we will. I'll restart those direct deposits to your account. After this episode clears. Perfect. And then also joining us from her secure undisclosed location, which I have heard there may be fermented great beverages nearby, Yvette Johnson.
Yes, there might be fermented great beverages, adult beverages nearby. Yes, I am well. Thanks.
Fantastic. So tonight, everybody, we're going to be talking about a topic that's really I've been in the news a lot lately, and it's something that I know a bunch of us either work directly or indirectly with, but we're all concerned about, and that's medical device security. And we have an outline that will be included as show notes, so you can kind of see where we're coming from on it. But, you know, Andy, one of the things I think, you know, you and I both do IT security for hospitals, and it's probably fair to say that at least in the 6 years I've been doing this, there's really not been this kind of focus on medical device security overall that I've ever seen.
Yeah, and you have, you know, you've definitely got some experience on me in this particular field, but it just seems like, you know, in the 6 or 7 months that I've been, you know, in healthcare security, that it's like I walked in the door and I was hit in the face with it. And, you know, it just happens many times every day since then.
Right. And I think one of the challenges for me is when I try to have conversations with people around medical device security is there's this assumption that a medical device is a medical device is a medical device. And they are and they aren't. I mean, there's the stuff you see in the hospital. It's going to be, you know, the big infusion pumps, CT scanners, X-ray machines, big stuff that's sitting on a hospital network. And there's some level, and it varies, it can vary widely from hospital to hospital, on how much ecosystem protection that device is getting. And if it's getting any available updates, and those updates are being applied. Most hospitals do a pretty good job of managing their biomedical inventories and applying updates when they can. And that's a it's a very qualified statement that we may end up talking a little bit about later. But then there's also the personal devices. And I think those are the ones that probably concern me the most.
Yeah, it seems like that, you know, every day we're getting requests from doctor's offices for a particular vendor that wants to do something on our systems so that they can pull data off of pacemakers or insulin pumps or, you know, whatever the device may be. And then, you know, run that through. And most of the time, of course, they want the data to go back to them so that they can take it for their own, you know, profit, honestly, as well as being able to help the patient. But then there's these times they're wanting to bring in these devices and and they'll say this is going to be a, you know, a demo, or this is going to be a you know, we're going to give this to you for 6 months for you to check it out or whatever, and they just want to be able to walk in the door and connect it to our network without any kind of due diligence on our part whatsoever. And yeah, that's the stuff that scares me, because when we do go back and look at this stuff, it's not uncommon to find, you know, some pretty serious and some pretty basic security flaws.
Absolutely. And one of the challenges is, and what makes healthcare security in general and medical device security specifically so critical, is that in Nick Selby, when I talked to him earlier this week, used the phrase, the cost of wrong. You know, the cost of wrong in a medical device can involve the serious injury or death of a patient. And we, in medical land and hospital land, it's referred to as a sentinel event. And these are sentinel events are where something happened, which, either did or had a very good likelihood of injuring or killing a patient. And these are worst case scenarios. No hospital wants you to come in, with the intention of being healed or cured, and they end up hurting you. No hospital wants that. So when they do, they're very big events because they involve life safety. So we know that there's a lot of the same threat landscape from medical devices, especially the personal ones they scare with the internet of very crappy things. But the consequences are really different between your Nest thermostat getting hacked and your St. Jude, you know, defibrillating pacemaker getting hacked. And that's why I think there's so much attention, and really one of the reasons that that we wanted to talk about this tonight. But there's some huge challenges that we face in fixing this problem. And Joseph, I know that you're familiar with the stuff in this space. So what do you see as sort of being the big issues from your perspective that manufacturers are facing and try to fix this problem?
Yeah, manufacturers face a really interesting, I guess, problem in this space. You know, one of the first things that really jumps out to me that I see a lot of manufacturers dealing with is just that there's lead times for device approval. When you're bringing a new something to market, the lead times for that can be literally years. So you may start development on a current operating system, on a what's considered a secure operating system at the time. But as time goes on, and as you're going through the development cycle, as you're getting stuff ready, you're chasing a moving target relating to security. And we all have experienced this in every field, but it especially hits those medical devices particularly hard. And once you do finally get yourself ready for market, you run into some problems, particularly – well, problems is probably the wrong word there. You run into some challenges around FDA compliance and fixed configurations. See, when you're bringing a new device to market, there are specific configurations. There are specific ways that a medical device is tested and certified as safe for sale, basically. And medical device manufacturers are – very gun shy about messing with a configuration that got them ready for sale. So that's kind of it disincentivizes device manufacturers to really get things ready. And then you're also faced with the challenge of the working life of device. When you're selling these devices, particularly the space that I have experience in, is the hospital devices side. But when you're talking about like a 5 Tesla MRI or something like that, this is a multiple $1 million purchase for a hospital. And they want that device when they buy it to last for a long time. So you have these devices that are in the field for longer than what you would ever think of using a personal device for, like your iPad or something like that. So you face a lot of challenges in that regard.
Right. And if you take that really long working life, you know, 10, 15, up to 20 years for some of these devices, especially, you know, these multi-million dollar devices, sometimes when we talk, when I've talked with folks around the challenge that, you know, there are these legacy devices, there's pumps and, you know, x-ray machines and just things that are connected to people, and people who aren't familiar with healthcare say, well, just replace them. it's hundreds of millions of dollars at a small community hospital that they have, you know, invested in these assets that they were planning on lasting for a really long time. And they simply don't have the financial wherewithal. Even extremely financially successful hospitals don't have the financial wherewithal to just start replacing stuff willy-nilly. Now, earlier this week, I spoke with Nick Selby, and we talked a bit about medical security and medical device security. And we'll be releasing the entire interview with Nick next week as sort of a bonus track. But just briefly, as we were talking, you know, he had a comment that he made to me around medical device and sort of what his experience was in this space. So here's Nick.
The issue, though, is those economics that you mentioned. I was speaking to a friend over New Year's about those, and that's really where it all comes down to, right? These huge tales of finance in maintenance of doctors and hospitals and practices that will never update certain kinds of equipment, and having to go back and change something that's been in the field long enough that if you have to change something major, it just destroys the whole profitability of the entire product line.
And that's it, right? It comes down to you can only afford to replace what you can afford to replace. This is why if you live in a rural area or go to a small single practitioner, that X-ray machine that they have on site might be older than you. I'm not saying it's unsafe. As a matter of fact, they're certified to be safe, and there's tests they have to do. But this stuff's really, really old. And I don't think we, you know, to the point you made, Joseph, I don't think we've gotten to the point where we understand with, you know, computer technology, they age out so fast that it's really hard for us to do anything about it. So right now, we've sort of been Debbie Downer, right? We've talked about all the problems. We've talked about all the challenges, everything from, you know, the cost to, you know, these vendors. You know, Andy brought up the vendors that come in for a trial and they don't, you know, it's usually shadow IT that's doing it and there's no one involvement. And Andy, I know you know the truth. There's nothing more permanent in a hospital than a temporary solution.
yeah.
It's just, it's the nature of the industry. So we're here to cast some light, you know, and not just curse the darkness. So, you know, Yvette, I know you've been talking a lot about and thinking a lot about vulnerability disclosure. And, you know, I talked recently with Nick, and we talked about his involvement in the whole Muddy Waters, St. Jude, MedSec thing. So what are your thoughts on the space?
Well, thinking about, you know, true vulnerability disclosure, you know, in the past, you know, software and hardware vendors relied on the security of secrecy, right? They hope that they could find these vulnerabilities themselves and fix them before anything was exploited by a hacker or even a security researcher. But that's changed, right? Vulnerability disclosure has changed all that. And now, you know, people or security researchers are exposing this publicly. And these, in order to, you know, get these software and hardware vendors to patch these issues quickly and not just say, you know, this is going to be expensive and hard, we're not going to do it. And that's what exactly happened in the Muddy Waters St. Jude case. But they took a little bit farther in respect that, you know, Muddy Waters was like, hey, you know, this is just beyond somebody saying, hey, BT Dubs, St. Jude, you might want to fix this. They hit them where it hurt, in their pockets. And, you know, Muddy Waters said, you know, we hired our own security consulting company to do our own research. They uploaded videos of the failures and showed exactly how these cardiac devices, where these attacks could happen, and got into almost a financial pissing match with St. Jude Medical. Which St. Jude Medical turned around and sued Muddy Waters in September. And then, you know, Muddy Waters was claiming that they were attacking their First Amendment rights, their rights for free speech. So it got pretty ugly. And the entire time, the FDA was kind of sitting back with popcorn saying, you know, work it out amongst yourselves. We still think these devices are safe and that the issues are minimal, and we're not going to do anything about it.
Well, and that's that use of the word safe points out one of the problems. The FDA, when they use the word safe, they're meaning the device will be safe, it will be efficacious and not cause harm to the patient when used in the approved configuration according to the instructions.
They're safe-ish.
No, they're safe when they're used as directed in the configuration directed. The problem is the FDA doesn't. They're sort of changing, but for the longest time, they never considered the malicious use case to be a valid use case. They said, well, oh, someone altered the certification, therefore, you know, that's something else, right? We're not going to wager an opinion on that. I think lately, and I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more about this, is the FDA seems to be moving in the right direction to where they're understanding there are malicious use cases. And in fact, with the St. Jude devices, they ordered a recall, which is the first time I can think of that that a recall happened.
But yeah, and Martin, yeah. Real quick, I do want to jump in. That point that you just made regarding the difference in safety versus or the safety the way the FDA classifies it and the way that the healthcare industry has been trained to look at it versus the way that the public views device safety, particularly the information security community and things like that. That is probably the greatest disconnect. And so if you missed that, go scoot yourself back about a minute and listen to what Martin said again.
And I think the other thing, and Yvette, you sort of alluded to, and I want to kind of pound this into the ground because I think people are conflating two issues. So Muddy Waters is a hedge fund. They make money by making bets on stock. MedSec is a research group. What offended a lot of people was that Muddy Waters, prior to releasing the information about the St. Jude devices, started shorting St. Jude stock. And then when they released the information, St. Jude stock fell in value, Muddy Waters made money. I think it's really important as information security people, especially when we start talking about vulnerable disclosure, that we park that aspect of it to the side for a second. It is okay to feel icky about that, right? And I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a stockbroker. None of us, except maybe Steve, are. And you can have an opinion on that. But when you talk about the vulnerability disclosure, that's a different thing. And I think MedSec, when you listen to the Nick Selby interview bonus track, you'll see where he goes through and he points out they did a really fantastic job in the way they not only documented it, but when they brought Bishop Fox in to validate the findings. So, vulnerability disclosure. Andy and Steve, when we first started this thing, lo those many years ago, that was one of the hot topics, right?
Oh, yeah. We had many a rant on that.
And
we can have more if we like.
No, but and I think we all thought this topic would go away at some point, and I was wrong.
Well, and just like we pointed out, it's no longer a security researcher blasting on Twitter. Like I said, it's now they're going after their pockets, and they're saying, "Hey, we're going to affect what your pockets for the next 2 years." I mean, that's essentially what Muddy Waters did. Is, you know, this is going to affect, this is 46% of what you do, of your business, and we're going to try to ruin that until you fix this.
See, I don't know, that's one way of looking at it. I also think Muddy Waters, you know, they were there to make money.
Well, yeah, absolutely, because they benefited. They weren't just the do-gooders like, hey guys, look what we found.
Oh, yeah.
No, they obviously made money.
Absolutely. I mean, I see meds, if there's a do-gooder in here, it's MedSec. Muddy Waters simply, they're these guys who have money and want to make more money. Now, one of the
St. Jude Medical went after them too. They're suing them as well.
Yep. So, Steve, one of the things that you and I talked about before we started recording was the concept of bug bounties And I'm just in my head, I'm still trying to figure out how that works.
So you and everybody else, about a year ago, actually, the FDA came out and they started making the case to medical device manufacturers to allow what they call good faith hacking. And it's a good initiative, and it also shows that, you know, things are going to start getting better. But I think it was last September, and I can't even remember the conference I was at, sorry. Somebody had made the point that it's getting better, but it's really slow. And so that's where the bug bounties come in, because when you open things up and you give people a chance to poke around, you can find flaws that you might have overlooked and get them fixed. But the problem is, in the medical world, you can't just let anybody go around poking at devices. And they're exceedingly expensive to purchase, so I can't go out and buy one and set it up in my house and play with it. So you're kind of caught between a rock and a hard place. But while we were getting set up, I just did a passive look, and I did not find on the two big ones, HackerOne and BugCrowd, I didn't see anybody standing out as like a medical device manufacturer or anything that was allowing for any type of bounty program. But I think if we're going to get better at this, that's exactly what we're going to need, some type of setup, and so does the FDA, so they're pushing for it. But it's going to be so slow, it's going to be frustrating, and my big concern would be, you know, while there's progress being made, it'll be such a slow, steady progression that people think nothing's changing.
Could be. So, I mean, we brought up the FDA, and the FDA has stood up a task force on this, and Joseph, I know you've seen some of their stuff. I've seen some of their stuff. We know some people who are involved in it. What do you think?
You know, the FDA is really starting to make strides. Steve, you mentioned their kind of push. That started in winter of last year, actually January of last year, as they really started to talk about changes to things like you know, their guidance around things like device patching. They started talking more about vulnerability disclosure for device vendors and things like that. And there's a lot of great ideas, but they're slow moving, and it doesn't feel like there's a common direction. At least that's kind of the sense that I've gotten so far. You know, I'll make sure that I put some links in the show notes around some of the things that the FDA has been announcing. But again, these things are slow to come, and in the kind of the fast-paced security world, it feels awfully slow, at least from my own perspective.
And I think you're right. I mean, government, by definition, generally doesn't move very fast, I believe, with all deliberate speed. But there are some other groups out there that are trying to accelerate things. And I know that you've gone out and you've looked at some of them. I've looked at some. So what are some of the ones that you see out there that maybe interested listeners could take a look at to see what other people think?
So it's funny. We started doing some research for this episode about a week ago, and I've been spending most of that time looking for things like medical device security related groups, whether that be special interest groups, whether that be things like that. And frankly, what I found is a bit disappointing. Most of it seems either a bit inactive. Some of these sites, for example, the MDISS, their last publicly published document was June of 2012, relating to fuzzing. So, you know, some of these groups, you might have to do a little more digging to see if they're even still active. I know there are some active groups like the NHISAC. You have the HIMSS cybersecurity community, which is you'll have to do some research to see how effective it really is, particularly if you want to get involved. One of the better groups out there is the Archimedes Center for Medical Device Security. I've had the opportunity to chat with some of the folks around there, at least in the past. And those guys are doing not only some good research and publishing that, but they're also – they have their own lab where they're testing medical devices specifically around cybersecurity. And then I've avoided one particular group, but I do want to make sure that I do bring them up, and that is I Am the Cavalry. We've had Josh Corman on this podcast before. I believe we were discussing I Am the Cavalry from the car side of things. However, last year, about this time, that I Am the Cavalry got together a handful of medical device researchers, and they published what they call their Hippocratic Oath. I'll make sure there's a link in the show notes for that. It's worth a look. I Am the Cavalry has some really solid ideas, but again, I do think that there can be that disconnect, particularly around things like patient safety, where you see the difference between people who are continuously inside the industry and those who tend to be on the outskirts of it.
Right. So lastly, folks, we need to talk about what the future is going to bring. And I've sort of in the last couple of years when we've done our year-end reviews and sort of like our predictions for the future, I've sort of been a downer, because I'm convinced that, you know, sometime, somewhere, somehow, something bad is really going to happen. And somebody's going to die, and it's going to be inextricably linked to a compromised medical device. And I want desperately to be wrong, but I don't know, given the track we're on, how we avoid that. Can someone tell me that I'm wrong and convince me so that I can sleep well tonight?
I could, but I'd just be lying to you. I mean,
you're always there for me, Steve.
I know. It's just that the medical device industry is so complex and spread out that even if you were able to jot down a list of like the top 100 most common things that you need to fix and patch right now to prevent this from ever happening, somebody's going to find issue number 101 and that'll be the trigger.
Right.
It's running in place almost, but it will get better. See, the thing is, people are already starting to talk about it. And for the longest time, if you think about it, enterprise security was mostly the same way. We knew we needed security. We knew that, you know, we had to have it, and we bought some of it. But we really didn't spend on security until something bad happened.
Right.
You needed that catalyst. So we've already had the catalyst.
One hopes. One hopes.
Yeah, well, no, I honestly think the St. Jude stuff, believe it or not, I think that's a good enough catalyst. Because, and this is going back to earlier points, but here we see two different types of catalysts. We have demonstrable physical harm caused by a connected medical device and financial harm to the bottom line caused by researchers. Or not researchers, sorry, but caused by the disclosure of said information.
Right.
That's a catalyst on both ends.
I see that.
It's a different kind of catalyst.
Yeah. And I think it's going to require a multitude of pressures to get us where we need to be. So lastly, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think one of the things that is, you know, delaying this or hurting this is, you know, the fact that the hospitals aren't demanding this yet. And it's not just a cost issue. It's a convenience issue. Cause I know you hear this every day, Martin. You know, it's like, we've got to be able to do X, and what you're wanting to do is either going to slow it down by a millisecond or whatever. But, you know, and when it comes to the vendors, we talk to the vendors and we start looking at their security practices, and they're like, you're the first hospital that has asked us about this. You're the first hospital that has required that we do, you know, whatever it may be. And I think that that's, you know, and this is a good thing that, you know, the hospitals, the doctors, the administrators have such a focus on being able to make sure that patient care is as easy as possible, that they're almost willing to overlook a lot of this stuff, or not almost, they are willing to overlook it, because they see the risk not being as great state as the risk of a life being lost because, you know, something like a doctor not being able to remember his password.
Right. And I think what it boils, what it ends up with is there's multiple regulators in the space. There's the FDA, there's CMS, there's the FTC. And I think the attention that's been, that we're starting to see on other IOVCT things, look at like what's happening with D-Link. The FTC is going after them, and we're seeing a recall that the FDA forced. I think the regulators are going to have to step up. I think they're going to be forced to just through public pressure. I don't want to bring politics into it, but there comes a point when sensible regulation and sensible standards are the things to do. So guys, we have consumed every available moment that we have, and I want to thank you for being here tonight. On behalf of everyone here at the Southern Fried Security Podcast, we're glad you're here. What we do want to do is remind you that next week we'll be releasing a episode 189 bonus track, which will be the conversation I had with Nick Selby earlier this week. You don't want to miss that. And thanks, everyone, and good night.
Good night.